My name is Deepa. I'm from the New York District, and I will be chairing this meeting. And we're very pleased and delighted that Cindy and Craig Corey could be with us here today. I'm sure they have many accomplishments, but today they're going to be speaking about the cause for which their daughter gave her life. Rachel Corey was killed in 2003. She was run down by an Israeli bulldozer, a machine that actually destroys the homes of Palestinians. And she was there actually precisely to stop this from taking place, to stop the kind of brutality and violence that the Israeli state uses against Palestinians. And she became a victim of this violence. And since her death in 2003, her parents have actually tirelessly traveled around the country, raising awareness of the Palestinian cause. And even against hostility and criticism, they have persevered and endured and actually made this argument. So we're very honored to have them here. And without further ado, I'll hand it over to Cindy or Craig.
So whoever's trying to tape here, I'm going to drive you nuts, because I like to kind of get out from behind this. I see that the title of our talk is What Every American Should Know About Israel and Palestine. And all I can talk about is what little I know about it, what Cindy knows. So if you want your money back, it's not our division. You're going to have to talk to somebody else. But indeed, actually, I'll tell you a little bit about what Cindy and I have been doing lately, because it's been kind of interesting, in fact, very interesting and very fulfilling to us. We've spent the last 3 weeks, a little more than 3 weeks, actually, about 3.5 weeks traveling with Khaled Samah and Sama Nasrallah. And that's they are people that were living in the home and standing behind the wall that Rachel was in front of when she was killed. There are actually two Palestinian families there. They're brothers that owned an upstairs-downstairs duplex. And this is the younger brother, his wife, and their smallest child. Sama is only 15 months old, so she was not alive when Rachel was killed. But we've been traveling around the United States and talking to people. About 7 months after Rachel was killed, their home was destroyed. We've since joined, Cindy and I are on the board of a group called the Rebuilding Alliance. We have some brochures of theirs back in the back that you're welcome to. We're trying to rebuild homes in Gaza, and we wanted to start with a Nasrallah home, I think because it's probably the most well-known, so we're hoping that that then gets some attention and that people start to understand what's going on there. And we can talk a little bit more about that as we go. But we have been traveling, I don't know how many talks we've given, close to 24 talks during that time, and that doesn't include being on radio or talking on interviews and stuff. So it's been a very busy time. We just got done with it. We came from Iowa City back out here to talk, and the Nasrallah family were to fly out of eastern Iowa but changed their tickets to fly out of Chicago and are getting on a plane as we speak. Cindy's relatives are helping them get loaded up. But so that's kind of what we've been doing lately. And it's been very fulfilling. It's a beautiful family. The Khaled Nasrallah and his wife have two other children that did not make the trip with him, but two other girls under the age of 5 that are staying with their grandparents in Alexandria. And they'll be back there however long it takes to fly from Chicago to Alexandria, but about a day. So that's been a real fun time for us. I'll tell you just a little bit. I've been introduced. I think you know. Do all of you know sort of something about Rachel? We don't really have to go too much through that. Although Cindy will talk more about Rachel, about our tie with the Nasrallah family. Probably, and usually when we've been giving these talks, I talk a little bit about where Rafah is and what's going on. And I don't know if that's elementary, but I'll go through it kind of fast for this group, and we can kind of get on to the discussion, which I think will be more fun anyhow. But Rafah is at the southern tip of the Gaza Strip. The Gaza Strip is about 30 miles long and varies in its width about, 10 miles wide, 5 miles wide, depending on where you measure it. It sits kind of in the, if you were looking down from the north, it'd be in the lower right-hand corner of where you see Israel. It's kind of cut out from Israel, as is the West Bank. Israel is between Gaza and the West Bank. They're divided that way, and Gaza is along the Mediterranean Sea. Its southern border joins with Egypt in the Egyptian Sinai. So Egypt owns land, this great desert, across from sort of where Cairo is. And that's that border is with Gaza. And Rafah is a town on that border. And when I say on that border, I mean on the border. It's now divided by that border, which wasn't real important when Egypt control both the Sinai and Gaza Strip, or after a couple of wars, when Israel controlled both Gaza and the Sinai. But now that Gaza has been given back to Egypt by Israel, that border becomes incredibly important. So what was a neighborhood with a lot of houses in it and everything, they started establishing this border and bulldozing down some of those houses. And first, I think, from what we could see when Cindy and I were there in the fall of 2003, in some places there was a lot of razor wire and then just cleared land. And then they came along from the west behind that and built a large steel wall. That steel wall, in the places we saw it, looked to be about 2 to 3 stories high, and we're also told it goes well down into the ground, and it's going through neighborhoods. Now, you're talking about a place, as I described, the size of Rafah, and forgive me a little bit, we usually have slides, and I can just kind of read stuff I'm supposed to remember to say out there. Gaza is one of the most densely populated places on Earth. It is about the size of Manhattan with twice the population. And essentially, almost no economy, because they used to go to work in Tel Aviv and places, but now it's been sealed off. And so I haven't really seen much of the sealing between Gaza and Israel, but nobody can get through it. So it's either wire or wall in such a fashion, you ain't getting through it. We have been through the checkpoint that everybody goes through, a Erez checkpoint, and that's like, I guess, about a half a mile walk through different places where people check your ID, and you aren't getting through there unless they allow it to, believe me. So it's walled off, it's sealed off, and astoundingly, not just from Israel, but also from Egypt, because the Israeli military controls this border into Egypt, and they have now, since Cindy and I were there, they replaced that razor wire with this wall all the way down. And they then have been bulldozing houses away from the wall. And the way they do that is not like, you know the trauma if you've lived through it at all, when in the United States a superhighway freeway comes through a neighborhood and divides that up. But that goes through, you know, years of study and condemning and paying for and evaluating a house. Here's a little bit faster. They come usually... They start by coming with armored personnel carriers or tanks and shooting into the houses. And so the Nasrallah's home was no exception to that. There are bullet holes coming through the walls. Rachel wrote about it and talked about the two front rooms, which were the children's bedroom, being full of bullet holes. So the whole family, children and parents, sleep in the back room on the floor, the children on the floor, and that's where Rachel slept with these children. So most families, if bullets keep flying through the house, and these homes are made out of reinforced concrete, the bullets will go through 2 or 3 walls. So that's a heavy-duty bullet going through there. That might be a 50 cal, I'm not sure. Anyhow, that's what they put up with. Most families, sooner or later, then say, enough, I'm getting out of here. They can't go out, of course, when somebody's shooting, because they'll just shoot them. But if they manage to get out, then when somebody's not shooting, then the house is considered abandoned, and then they just come in and bulldoze it down. There's no compensation. There's no particular warning. The way you know that a bulldozer is bulldozing your house is sometimes the warning would be by bashing down part of one wall and then stopping, and they'll come back and destroy the rest of it later on, like the next day. In the Nasrallah's case, It was a much more known house because of Rachel being killed there. And so Rachel was killed in March of 2003, in October of 2003, which was Operation Rainbow, right?
No,
Root Canal. They had these terrible, 1984 just came like 20 years late. But anyway, Operation Root Canal, they came in, told the family, we'll push down this house with you in it if you don't leave. But then they also dug around three walls of the house down, they tell us, about 5 to 7 meters right up against the foundations. Now, that's sand out there, concrete. So as soon as they did that, those foundations became wobbly. The family actually was corralled for at least several hours. I'm not real sure about this story, but they took them over to another house and separated them and sort of threatened them and asked questions and everything for a number of hours, but then led them back into their own home. But at that time, they couldn't be in the building because every time a tank could go past, the whole concrete structure would start to wobble. So they slept for 3 days out in the garden, and then just essentially gave it up because there's no living there. By that time, the digging had cut off their water, their sewage, their electricity was cut, and they'd also mounted up the only road to their house so nobody could come visit them. They were just simply trapped there. And so they managed to get out. So that's kind of the story of this family. They then got out. The brother that we traveled with and his family, I think, moved 4 times after they were their house was destroyed. His older brother, who lived on the downstairs portion of it, they moved 7 times. And at one time, they moved into a neighborhood they thought would be very safe, and it turned out to be in May, exactly where the bulldozers came. So they were trying to get out the door as a bulldozer was coming through the wall. So they've lived under a great deal of stress, much of which they laugh about. They tell a wonderful story about how do you maintain your sanity when you are under this sort of stress, and that you're living at the end of a road that nobody can go down because they're afraid to be shot, so you have no neighbors coming to see you, no family coming to see you, and you're frightened to go visit them. When you come home, you stay home, and then when you go to work, you go to work, and you also leave somebody in the home, an adult in the home all the time, so somebody doesn't accuse it of being abandoned. And they wondered how to keep some humanity through all that. And as Khaled says, the answer was the rabbitses. They got rabbits. They got 3 rabbits. They read about how you care for rabbits, and build hutches, and learned about giving them shots and cleaning them. And the whole family, the 2 brothers' family, so it would have been 5 children and 4 adults, would gather together once or twice a day and take care of these rabbits. And they started out with 3 rabbits, and in 3 months they had 30 rabbits. And that's kind of how they maintained their humanity. And then when the bulldozers came to destroy their house, they pleaded for the rabbits as well. They were forced out of the house, and they asked the Israeli Defense Force, can we open the cages and let the rabbits out? And they said, no, you cannot. And so they had to leave all their belongings and their rabbits behind. Now, amazingly, they came back a few days later. The house still stood, and they actually not only got the rabbits out, they found them homes that somebody else had cared for them. And these, I asked them about it because you think in a desperately poor area where you've now got 30 rabbits that these rabbits might be lunch or something, but they weren't. They were pets. And so they found somebody else that would treat these rabbits for pets. So that's the kind of people we've been traveling with, and just having an amazing time talking to groups like yours and other groups around the country about that. Maybe it's a good time, because I wanted to have time to share things and have a discussion. Maybe it's a good time to introduce Cindy. She'll kind of talk about our relationship, why this family means so much to us, and share a little bit of Rachel, which is some of the best part of our family. So, and I like to hear Cindy talk, so here you go.
Thank you.
Put that in there.
No, this is all right. I think this will be fine. Thank you, everyone, for being here and for giving us this opportunity. I know that there are a lot of areas that we could touch on if we were really to try to tell you everything Americans should know about this situation. It's really pretty daunting. I you know, we are involved in an investigation. We have a lawsuit against Caterpillar Corporation. We've been involved in calling for, taking action against Caterpillar Corporation and so forth in other ways. There is Gaza disengagement happening. There are all kinds of aspects to all of this. I was asked, though, to talk a bit about Rachel because I know some of you know more than others, so I'm going to do that. But I hope that in the course of the discussion and so forth, we can touch on what we know about some of these other areas as well. It was really 911 that brought Rachel to this issue. I remember her phone call that day. She had planned a trip to come to visit us. We were living in North Carolina at the time, and that very week she was supposed to join us in Boston, and then we were going to go to North Carolina. She had never visited us there. I remember the bewilderment in her voice. Why had this happened on 911? And it was really that question that then took her to the peace and justice movement in the Olympia, in our community in Olympia, Washington, where she had grown up. She had always been involved in, people asked early on, was she always an activist? And when I look back, at first I thought, no, she's just my kid, Rachel. But then when I look back, I saw that, yeah, there was always that interest in something beyond herself, in something beyond her hometown, that interest in the rest of the world, and that did sometimes translate into activism at a very young age. But she really connected after 911 with the peace and justice community in Olympia. There were a lot of groups that became active, I'm sure in your communities as well at that time, but we had Olympians for Peace in the Middle East, the Olympia Movement for Justice and Peace, the Fellowship of Reconciliation, and she connected with all those people. And then that took her very quickly to the Israeli-Palestinian issue as a root cause of what had happened on 911 and of the difficulties that we were having in relating to the Middle East. She was really mentored by people in our community who had spent time in the West Bank and in Gaza during the 80s and the 90s, came back and continued their work, again, as I'm sure some of you have. And also by an Israeli woman who was on the Evergreen State campus whose parents had survived the Holocaust, who had grown up in Israel and lived there for 29 years, and then was a co-founder of Women in Black when she had, after looking at this situation long enough and closely enough, decided that the occupation was wrong and needed to end, both for the benefit of Palestinians but also for the benefit of Israelis. And so Simona was on the Evergreen State College campus with the Peace and Justice Studies Association at the time, and Rachel was, able to work with her directly to learn more about this whole situation. I share all of that because for our family, this issue was really out on the periphery. It wasn't one that we had a direct connection to, and it wasn't one that I worked on. I feel some remorse about that, because I think if maybe people in my generation, if more of us had known, if more of us, when we did know that something was wrong, had taken some action, then maybe our children would have been out there trying to do what Rachel was doing, what others were doing. Our sympathies had always been really with Israel, because that was the story that we knew about. I read to Rachel stories about the Holocaust, about children who survived, about children who didn't survive, and to her brother and sister. We spent a lot of time reading together, talking about all these things. But we really didn't know the Palestinian story. One of the things that's been really the most wonderful part of this for me is that Palestinian Americans have become visible to me because they've come to us in the aftermath of Rachel's killing. And I've learned that there are Palestinians living in my community, Olympia, Washington. And certainly we've met and heard from people all over the world who share stories. Some of the kind of sadder part of that is that I've talked to people who have really kept their stories under wraps to some degree, because for many years they didn't feel very safe sharing those stories, or they saw that when they did tell their stories that there were repercussions for their children. And I hope that that's changing, but I know that it isn't everywhere. It isn't with everybody that they encounter. But they're very important stories to tell, like the Nasrallah family, who in 1948 were forced from the village of Serafand in what was the Palestine Mandate at that time, and went to Rafah. So many others that we talk about or hear talk to in 48, they remember or have heard the stories of what happened to their family, and they've ended up in all many, many, many parts of the world. Back to Rachel, in the summer of 2002, friends of hers went with ISM, the International Solidarity Movement, to the West Bank, and a couple went to Gaza. I want to say just a little about ISM, because there is a lot of misinformation out there about ISM. This organization was founded when, in the United Nations, there was a resolution submitted by the High Commissioner for Human Rights, Mary Robinson, after the start of the First Intifada, to have an international peacekeeping force go to the region. And that resolution was vetoed by the United States and by Israel. And at that time, ISM was founded. It was founded by Netta Golan, who is an Israeli, by Ghassan Andoni, a Palestinian, by Huwaida Arif, who is a Palestinian-American, and another co-founder at the time was Adam Shapiro, a Jewish-American who happens to be married to Huwaida. The group has only two requirements. It's still functioning. Their Freedom Summer 2005 is happening, is getting underway now. In the West Bank, it's almost impossible, really, for ISM to get into Gaza now, or for most anyone else, for that matter. But ISM is active in the West Bank, even though the Israeli government has made it very difficult for anybody. You can't go in and say you're going with ISM. You will be stopped at the border. People are very heavily scrutinized to see if they're going to participate with ISM, because ISM has been a real thorn. For the Israeli military, and they right now a lot of their work is in villages in the West Bank, where the wall there is being still opposed, and Palestinian villagers are coming out, joined by Israelis and by internationals, to oppose the wall. And this is a Palestinian-led movement, ISM, and internationals from all over the world have joined it. So Rachel's friends went in 2002. She heard what they were writing back, what they were seeing. And then in the late summer, she told us that she was thinking about going as well. For a little bit, you know, we were across the country, didn't know how much time she had already invested in learning about this situation. And she was studying herself. She was started studying Arabic. She did a lot of reading, documentary viewing, and that sort of thing, as well as talking to people. But for a little bit, we tried to think maybe there was some other safer place that she could go. But I knew very quickly how important it was to her to do this. And Craig and I have never felt that it was our job. She was 23, almost 24. It wasn't our job to try to talk her out of doing something like this. And I knew that even if we tried, we wouldn't succeed anyway. In January of 2003, she traveled to the West Bank for training with ISM and then went very directly and very intentionally to Rafah. She went there because she believed that it was maybe the most isolated part of the West Bank and Gaza Strip, the place that had maybe the most dire kind of circumstances, living circumstances for people, where the need was greatest. There was, as I said, a very small ISM presence at that time, and ISM was looking for people that were willing to go. When she went, the kinds of work that she did were varied. I'll just give you a few examples. ISMers were called upon by the municipal water workers, Palestinian municipal water workers, to go while the workers were repairing wells that had been destroyed in January. Two wells that supplied almost half of Rafah's water supply had been destroyed by the Israeli military. And when the municipal water workers tried to get those up and running again, they were fired upon by these towers that were along the borders. How many of you have been there, by the way? I'm just curious. Not very many people, but a few. I'm sorry we don't have our photos, and you can, you know, go online and see photos like this, but there are these towers that are all along this border strip, and firing would happen from those or from tanks along the border strip as well. But in this case, I think it was from the towers, and they would fire on the municipal water workers. So ISM was called on. They went out with their banners, made it clear that they were internationals. They felt that they had some protection by being internationals. And in fact, in that situation, it worked. They were able to complete repairs to the wells. Rachel also worked in the children's parliament with young kids. And they were really practicing democracy, talking about the issues, learning how to debate the issues that affected their lives. Craig and I visited the Children's Parliament when we were there in September 2003. We were in Rafah for about 6 days and nights, a really extraordinary time. We went to bed every night hearing shelling coming from the border. It sometimes lasted all night long. One night, there was an incursion about a quarter of a mile away from us. You would see tracers as you went to bed going across the sky. It was amazing to me, though, that I'd look out that window and see the moon, this gorgeous moon over Rafah. And it was, you know, kind of such a heartening thing that in this, you know, just to be reminded that even in this place where there's so much strife, that there's still these beautiful things. But the children in the Children's Parliament were definitely beautiful as well. And I just want to tell you about three of them, three boys who did part of the welcoming for us. One sang a song, and he had this gorgeous voice, and we were told that Rachel had loved his voice. She was a singer, so I know that she would have encouraged him in his singing. And they all danced the Debka dance for us. I hadn't seen Debka before that. I hope you all have a chance sometimes to see this great Palestinian dancing. And then there was a third boy who said, made a speech, and he said, when Rachel first came to Rafah, I told all my friends not to play with her because she was an American. He was maybe 10 or 11 years old. And he said, I didn't trust Americans. And Khalid Nasrallah sometimes says that what people in Rafah know about the U.S., for the most part, is that they see the remnants of the equipment that says, of military equipment, of shells and so forth, that says made in the USA. So this young boy said, I didn't trust Americans. But then I saw Rachel playing football with my friends, and I thought, maybe she's not so bad after all. It was soccer. And she wasn't that great at it, but apparently they had a good time. And then he, very quietly, he said, and then she died. And he spoke so softly when he said those words, and he had these very penetrating eyes. I will always remember the expression on his face, because what I took from what he had to say was that not only had there been a transformation in how he felt about Rachel, but there was a bit of a transformation in how he felt about the rest of us, Americans. And Craig and I have, you know, continued to think about that as we do our work, thinking about the importance of these one-to-one relationships across borders and trying to build those, because the messages that we send can be very different from the ones that our governments send. Rachel, as Craig said, did stand in front of bulldozers, as do many other people in the area. Craig and I witnessed a demolition in the West Bank. We were with Rabbi Arik Asherman, who got a call the morning he was taking us to see some things and about a demolition that was happening in East Jerusalem. Arik Asherman has stood in front of bulldozers and was actually charged with interfering in Jerusalem with government business. And there was a trial, and he was found guilty, but they decided not to do anything to him because it would have just, I think, the PR would not have been good. He's a beloved person and so forth. But I just want you to know that, because you will read that Rachel was very naive. How stupid could you be to stand in front of a bulldozer? She shouldn't have been there anyway. People like Arik Asherman and Jeff Helper, who's with the Israeli Committee Against House Demolition, said, what do you mean she shouldn't have been there? She was standing there, standing for human rights and international law, and standing for the very basic human right of the right for families to be safe in their homes. That's something that is sacred to most Americans. And the questions that people like Jeff and Arik ask are, why aren't we all there standing to protect those human rights? Rachel was killed on March 16th, 2003, trying to protect and stand between a bulldozer and the Nasrallah house. Something that you don't hear too much, that I just urge you to think about and to share with other people that you may hear commenting about this, is that Rachel knew the children who were standing behind the wall. We've now spent time with that family, and I still get shivers when I think about the Sama, who was here just with us this last month, wasn't born yet, but she has two little sisters who were standing behind that wall, their parents, the three cousins whom we have met, and their parents. And Rachel, she couldn't have moved, knowing that this family, the children showed us where she had slept with them because they had to sleep in the parents' bedroom at the foot of the bed to avoid the bullets that Craig was talking about that would come through three walls. They showed us the English books that Rachel, they said, knew all the words in Arabic, and they were very proud of working on English with her. So I don't want to take much more time except to say that we are guided by Rachel's words. I just want to share with you a little bit of what she had to say about commitment to places. I continue to believe that my home, Olympia, could gain a lot and offer a lot by deciding to make a commitment to Rafa in the form of a sister community relationship. Some teachers and children's groups have expressed interest in email exchanges, but this is only the tip of the iceberg of solidarity work that could be done. Many people want their voices to be heard, and I think we need to use some of our privilege as internationals to get those voices heard directly in the U.S. rather than through the filter of well-meaning internationals such as myself. I'm just beginning to learn from what I expect to be a very intense tutelage in the ability of people to organize against all odds and to resist against all odds. Craig and I'm sorry that you didn't have the opportunity to hear directly from the Nasrallah family. If we'd known that there was going to be a change and they'd be flying out of Chicago, we maybe would have been able to arrange that, but that happened at the last minute for us. And but I think by bringing them here and letting them tell their own story, I know Julia's heard the story from them, we feel that we're carrying on Rachel's wish to get those voices heard directly here in the U.S. I'm going to read to you, maybe we can go to something else, but if I could read a poem of Rachel's maybe at the end. It's about Rafa, and it's a plea, I think, for us to remember this place. Maybe that would be a good way to close out the whole thing. Would that be all right? Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome. You can stop me when we've gone too long here.
Okay.
You can read your thing, too.
Yeah. I just wanted to say, in regard to the comments about one state and that, a separate Jewish state and so forth is fundamentally undemocratic and unequal, I think it is pretty hard, coming from our position here in the United States, to justify what's happened there. But for us personally, we haven't taken a position really on that, and I'll explain to you why. It's because as we talk, and we've talked to a lot of people around the world, and Palestinians and Israelis, we talk to people from both the Palestinian side and the Israeli side who find it really hard to think in terms of a one-state solution right now. I think for Palestinians that we talk to, there isn't the trust. I mean, there's still the feeling that if there's one state, they're still going to be under the thumb, and that after living under this occupation, under such oppression for such a long time, that they really need the opportunity to be their own, their own boss, so to speak. And then with Israelis, certainly very strong Zionist influence there, but also people that just think it won't fly, that one state at this point won't fly with the Israeli people, and certainly not with a lot of Jewish Americans as well. But we do talk with people who know the situation very well, Jeff Helper. I would really advise, how many people know about Jeff Helper? A few. He's Israeli with Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. Of all the people that we've talked to, I feel like he has been able to most clearly explain to us the facts on the ground. And it's very important to look at the facts on the ground, what's happening with the settlement, settlements continuing to be built in the West Bank and to be filled out, so that ultimately the West Bank will probably be divided by settlements at the infrastructure, the roads and so forth. He knows pretty much what's happened with every foot of space. And his thinking, I heard him a couple of, okay, time is up, Craig is saying, okay. Yeah, so I won't go any much further than that, but his thinking is ultimately, you know, it's going to be maybe a long time down the road that these two peoples are so dependent really on one another in a lot of ways that there will ultimately be some kind of one state or some kind of regional place, but that it's probably going to need to evolve. And I'm sure all of you probably have some well-thought ideas on that. I guess it is time for us to conclude. I did want to say something about thank you for commenting on the U.S. funding, which is so important. And Caterpillar, we do have a lawsuit. There are now Palestinians that have joined that lawsuit which we're very happy about. That was not, although when we filed the suit, it did get some media attention. When the Palestinians joined it, there was no media attention. So please help us to get that word out. There were people who were killed in Jenin and also in Gaza, and they are now a part of it. And some who were seriously injured as well. U.S. funding, we believe that our tax dollars paid for the Caterpillar D9R bulldozer that killed Rachel, and that they continue to be complicit in the human rights violations that continue. There are home demolitions that are threatened in Jerusalem right now, 88 homes threatened with demolition. I would just like to give you a couple of websites if you're interested in learning more. www.endtheoccupation.org, and that is the U.S. campaign to end the occupation. www.endtheoccupation.org. They have a lot of good information, links to other places. Also, the Electronic Intifada. I don't have the website, but there's a lot of good information there. You can Google it, Electronic Intifada. And then if you want to know about the rebuilding efforts that we're doing, www.rebuildingalliance.org, and it tells a lot about the Nasrallah story. I will close with Rachel's poem. Don't go away feeling too down about this. I think it's a plea for us all to just keep working on this issue. It was sent back to us in her journals from Rafa. Oh, Rafa, aching Rafa, aching of refugees, aching of tumbled houses, bicycles severed from tank-warped tires, and aching of bullet-riddled homes, all homes worm-eaten by bullets, and then impregnated through bullet holes by birds. Oh, Rafa, aching fingers of Rafa, children born without fingers and fathers unable to travel the 20 or 30 miles to Gaza to repair their children's fingers. Clawed knuckles from old gunshots, bandaged fingers, and slimy, small, poking fingers between puffy lips of children, slobbery and wondering and blinking like all children, but fingers patting and tapping at strange big hands amidst the music of shelling and the constant anonymous night vision telescope of murder above and beyond and around and even inside. Fingers, cracked crusts of spackle concrete fingers of the endless rebuilding of things crashed. Home, home. Oh, Rafa. Aching homes of Rafa. Home of the Rafa camp. Rafa grown permanent with the names of the countries that paid for the neighborhoods still attached. Home of Rafa, unleavable. Homes stickered with glow-in-the-dark stars in teenagers' rooms. Homes constructed over a lifetime and unraveled in the night. ache of rubble and weedy rebar craning out of concrete boulders. Ache of ghost homes looming without volume, without mass, straddling this wall and this wasteland the wall demands. Ache of dinners, knees and haunches, kneeling dinners spread over floors in the music of gunfire, the irregular heartbeat of the border, and living dead homes waiting immobile for bulldozers and tanks and the shattering of tea glasses, the bending of rebar, the tumbling of concrete, and the ejection of people. Baby, grandmother, small girl curling her entire small hand around one big finger. Teenage boy with teenage boy legs and teenage boy laugh, ejected into rubble and homelessness and scattered if not killed. Oh, Rafa, aching Rafa, children of Rafa exploded, children of Rafa deafened, deafened to tank wheels, deafened to explosions, gunshot music, shocking claps, drones. Thanks very much.